Hello and welcome to the Palliative Care Journal Watch podcast by Pallium Canada for February 2025, where our panel of palliative care experts keeps you informed of the latest peer-reviewed palliative care literature. Our host, Dr. Jose Pereira, joins us for the 16th episode of the Palliative Care Journal Watch. If you'd like to access accompanying slides and links to the articles discussed in today's podcast, visit the link in the episode notes. This podcast is a collaboration between Pallium Canada and the divisions of palliative care at Queen's University, McMaster University, McGill University, University of Toronto, University of Manitoba, University of Calgary, University of Alberta, and the Hadassah Hebrew University Medical Center in Israel. It is a part of the Palliative Care ECHO project, which aims to support continuous professional development among healthcare providers across Canada who care for patients with life-limiting illness. The Palliative Care ECHO project is supported by financial contributions from Health Canada. However, the views expressed in today's episode do not necessarily represent the views of Health Canada. With no further ado, it's time for the Journal Watch.
Hello and welcome to, our 16th episode or session of the Pallium Canada Journal Watch. It's hard to believe that we're already at the 16th, but welcome. I am Jose Pereira, and today we will be joined by my co-host, Dr. Sharon Watanabe and Dr. Iyengaran Sinaraja. Welcome. The Palliative Care Journal Watch is a regular series of webinars that keeps you up to date on the latest peer-reviewed palliative care literature. Palliative care experts from several divisions of palliative care medicine across Canada and internationally regularly monitor over 30 journals and highlight articles that have the potential to challenge us to think differently about a topic or perhaps sometimes even confirm our current practices. This program is part of Pallium Canada's Palliative Care ECHO project, which is supported by a financial contribution from Health Canada. Pallium Canada's ECHO project aims to cultivate communities of practice and provide additional palliative care-related continuous professional development opportunities for healthcare providers across Canada to complement its LEAP courses program. And we invite you to visit our website, www.echopalliative.com, where you can learn more and check out our upcoming ECHO sessions that cover a variety of palliative care-related topics. And in fact, you're also going to find the Journal Watch link over there where you can connect with previous episodes or sessions of our Journal Watch. So what to expect? Well, as always, we will highlight and discuss the top four articles that our editorial committee have selected from the many submitted by the teams monitoring the journals. We will also provide a list of honorable mentions at the end. The honorable mentions are articles that we thought are noteworthy, but due to time constraints, we were not able to discuss them in this session. A recording of each webinar, accompanying slides, and links to the articles covered will also be made available on our Pallium Canada ECHO project website. Introduction. So I'm Dr. Jose Pereira, and I'm Professor of Palliative Care at the Faculty of Medicine and the Institute for Culture and Society at the University of Navarra in Spain. I'm also a clinical professor in the Division of Palliative Care in the Department of Family Medicine at McMaster University in Canada, and I'm scientific advisor and co-founder of Pallium Canada. And with that, I'll hand over to Sharon, Dr. Sharon Watanabe, if you can introduce yourself.
Hello, I'm Sharon Watanabe. I'm a palliative care physician based at the Cross Cancer Institute in Edmonton, and I'm also a professor of palliative care medicine at the University of Alberta.
Thank you. And then Iyengaran, Dr. Sinaraja.
I'm Iyengaran Sinaraja. I'm chair of the Dr. Gillian and Gilchrist Palliative Care Research at Queen's University in Lake Rachelt, and I'm also an associate professor at the Queen's University. Nice to be here. Thank you.
Good. Thank you. Well, so in terms of disclosures, just very quickly, Pallium Canada is a registered charity. It's a foundation. Over the years has been funded by from various sources, including Health Canada. As we said earlier, the ECHO project is funded by Health Canada in the form of a contribution program. As scientific advisor, I do get some remuneration from Pallium Canada. And so that's part of the disclosures. And my colleagues have got no conflicts of interest to declare. So today's articles, well, again, as I said, there are four of them. And we do cover various areas. So the first one will be looking at the pharmacological management of severe chronic breathlessness in adults with advanced life-limiting diseases. Then we're going to be looking at the variability amongst oncologists in terms of prescribing systemic cancer therapies at the very end of life in the last 30 days. We're going to be looking at prescription opioid use disorder among adults. Fascinating article that Dr. Watanabe Sharon will be presenting for us. And we're going to end off with a paper looking at the palliative care needs of patients with heart failure. So with that, let's start with the first one. And over to you, Aingarang.
Thanks, Jose. As mentioned, so this article titled Practice Review, Pharmacological Management of Severe Chronic Breathlessness in Adults with Advanced Life-Limiting Ill Diseases by Simon et al. From Palliative Medicine, published in December 2024, volume 38, issue 10. And this goes into chronic breathlessness syndrome, which is common in a lot of advanced illnesses that we deal with in palliative care. And I do have to remind myself as I read this article that this is different from acute dyspnea that we will see also, such as COPD exacerbations, you know, some sort of cancer complications. And so they looked at this chronic breathlessness syndrome and what is the evidence for the use of pharmacological therapies, specifically antidepressants, benzos, opioids, and corticosteroids. The key points, just to cut to the chase, is that the evidence is weak, and therefore non-pharmacological options should be considered first line. Opioids maybe has some evidence, but it's very weak and conflicting. So the methods they used was the scoping review to find relevant guidelines and systematic reviews. They focused on those two drugs, and they focused on cancer, COPD, interstitial lung disease, or chronic heart failure. They looked at guidelines in the last 5 years and systematic reviews published in the past 10 years. And if no systematic reviews were found, they looked at primary studies as well. They included additional relevant guidelines, primary studies known to the expert panel. And they had this expert panel of 20 clinical experts and patient representatives. And consensus was achieved when at least three quarters approved it. So the results were that they found 8 international guidelines, 14 systematic reviews, and 3 randomized controlled trials that they had to go to for the antidepressant drugs class. And the conclusion was that the evidence for these 4 classes of drugs is weak. And so they recommended that the step one should be optimizing underlying condition which causes the breathlessness, pleural effusion, try to drain the effusion. Step two, use non-pharmacological options such as calming, breathing techniques, positioning, walking aids. And step three, then and only then carefully consider pharmacological treatment. They do caveat by saying that there might be exceptional circumstances such as dying phase, end-of-life phase, or plus-plus distress. And maybe then we can jump to step three quickly. Low-dose opioids to start, titrate very carefully. I wonder, Jose, whether you want to take over. My voice suddenly has dropped.
Sure. I thought you were going to present some of the evidence around coughing, and you were emulating that for us. So as we heard, step one is optimize the underlying condition. Step two is non-pharmacological options, which Aingarang reviewed. Step three is a pharmacological treatment with some caveats, as Aingarang was saying. In terms of the pharmacological treatment, it's pretty clear from the authors that nebulized opioids should not be used. There's insufficient or very limited evidence to support the use of nebulized opioids. And in terms of cancer patients and perhaps COPD, one could trial an opioid. And the author suggests less than 30 milligrams of morphine equivalent daily dose. Now, this is what this group felt based on their review. They also looked at heart failure and are not sure whether it will be helpful for heart failure. In terms of benzodiazepines, generally, they concluded that there isn't a role except for if anxiety or panic associated with severe refractory breathlessness. And in that case, 1 milligram per day and no long-term use unless in select cases there are clear benefits. They do describe that in the terminal phase, so in the last hours and days, one can add opioids and benzos. They don't describe in great detail what the rationale behind that is. which left me with a few questions. In terms of corticosteroids, no evidence. And in terms of antidepressants, no evidence. And when they say no evidence for the antidepressants, they looked at two randomized control trials and a pilot randomized control trial, and these were negative. So in the discussion, they highlight that the evidence for pharmacological therapies in managing chronic breathlessness is weak. They highlight the importance of non-pharmacological options, and that should be first-line treatment with a staged approach, as we described. The strengths of the paper was they reviewed some newer RCTs, and the expert panel provide practice recommendations. Obviously, as we know, expert panels also have got their limitations, and so we have to keep those in mind. And speaking of limitations, they spoke about the scoping review methodology did not appraise the quality of the included evidence, and the search strategy may have missed some relevant evidence. Overall, lack of high-quality evidence on pharmacological interventions for chronic breathlessness. And I must say, when I first saw this paper and another more recent one, which I think I'll mention shortly, I was left a little bit surprised because that is, you know, opioids, for example, is something that we do use for patients with severe dyspnea. And these are patients with cancer or several of the non-cancer diagnoses. And so I was left a little bit confused by this. And then I was reminded by a saying of Carl Sagan, the American astronomer, who once said something to the effect of absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. And so in the context of many, many studies that are negative, one can, I think, conclusively say there is no evidence. But in the context of not many studies or small studies, you know, I think the decision needs to be a bit more nuanced. So with that, let's turn over to discussion, and hopefully Eingeron has got his breath back and could add some of his thoughts on this, and then turn over to Sharon.
Sorry, apologies for that, and thanks for stepping in. It is interesting, as you mentioned, that we are using it more in palliative care, but the evidence is still not great. In fact, it is quite weak. But again, this expert panel mentioned that, you know, maybe there are some situations where loss of distress, the end of life phase, where maybe we can still try it. But I would say, despite that, I think most of us still practice with the thinking that opioids are not first line, really, isn't it? Like, we still try to address the underlying disease, underlying cause, find the effusions, the pericardial effusions, we go chasing. So it might actually, you know, align with what we are doing anyway. And just to be careful with some of these drugs, especially higher doses, because the evidence is quite weak, it looks like.
Interesting findings. And I think in the literature, we've been seeing similar conclusions drawn in recent years in different reviews. The other thing I would add is that we don't have really, when it comes to pharmacotherapy for dyspnea, we don't have a lot of options available. And so I think that is part of the motivation for using opioids, even though the evidence is not strong. We don't really have alternatives, you know, apart from the non-pharmacotherapeutic.
Yeah. It's interesting. When I saw the article, I was reminded of another one that, two that were published as well quite recently, and that pop up in the searches by our colleagues across the country. And one of them, and maybe even discussed that in the future Journal Watch, was an article by Yamaguchi and colleagues from Japan. And it was a treatment recommendation for dyspnea in patients with advanced disease, a revised clinical guidelines from the Japanese Society for Palliative Medicine. Very nice paper. They went through all the different options in detail, pharmacological, non-pharmacological. And in the section on opioids, so they've got sections on oxygen therapy, different forms of oxygen therapy, fan therapy, etc. In the section on opioids, they do suggest the use of systemic morphine for dyspnea in patients with advanced cancer. They suggest as well that there's evidence with oxycodone. So they do say there is some evidence with some of the opioids. Interestingly, though, they mentioned cancer, and I didn't see in the paper the non-cancer diagnoses. And then more recently, there's been this paper by Smallwood and colleagues that was published in the European Respiratory Review series. And I think it's starting a big debate, and it's about opioids and the palliation of symptoms and with people with serious respiratory illnesses. And it was just a systematic review and meta-analysis. And they concluded that basically opioids improved exertional breathlessness in laboratory exercise studies, but did not improve breathlessness, cough, or quality of life measured in daily life at home. I agree with you, Sharon, that, you know, we don't have a lot of options. And we do know, I think, from practice that there are some patients, some select cases that do benefit from it. I think a lot of the work in the future is going to be try to somehow identify the patients who would respond.
I mean, this review does say opioids does have some evidence. It's weak, but it does have evidence for cancer, COPD, and ILD. So that's probably congruent with what the Japanese review says. And I do see a comment in the Q&A around the underlying concurrent disorders does need to be goal concordant. That's a very good point with what the patient's goals are. And there can be limitations in some of the diagnostics and treatment options based on care settings, remote, rural. It may not be as easy to go chase a pericardial effusion, a pleural effusion, and things like that. So it's a very good point. And then there's a question. What is the evidence for the non-pharmacological strategies for breathlessness? But it's not clear what the evidence is for those in terms of effectiveness, which is a very good question. I have sort of scanned and read some articles around it, but I can't remember how strong that evidence is. And I don't know whether the others do.
The Japanese group, the Yamaguchi group, in their guidelines, their clinical guidelines of the Japanese society, do suggest a FANS therapy. So they did look at FANS therapy. And their recommendation is FANS therapy is recommended for dyspnea in patients with advanced disease. And it's a 1B, so in other words, a strong recommendation with moderate level of evidence. So that's the one. I didn't see others. We do know that respiratory physiotherapy is extremely important in patients with advanced lung diseases. And I think we really need to emphasize that. That can make a very big difference, and the sooner the better as well. So I think there's a fair amount of evidence in that area for non-pharmacological approaches, so the rehab. So next, the article that I'm going to present now was identified by Dr. Adir Shaloff, one of our Journal Watch team members at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, and who's specifically monitoring the cancer-related journals that we have. As an oncologist and as a palliative care physician, he's well positioned to monitor these, as is our own Dr. Sharon Watanabe, who's also an oncologist and a palliative care physician. So the background to this was that among patients with cancer approaching death, discontinuation of further cancer-directed systemic therapies may enhance a patient's quality of life. And they speak about the risk-reward trade-off of continuing treatments, and that this may shift towards the end of life with reduced potential benefits outweighed by toxicities and risks. However, in practice, they say there appears to be significant variability amongst oncologists in terms of the extent to which they continue to provide systemic treatments into the end of life, including the last 30 days. So the authors describe that discontinuation decisions are made harder by things such as socio-emotional processes. And the two examples they give are the need for difficult end-of-life conversations and pressure by some patients and families asking to do more. So they refer to some qualitative studies that have identified some of these factors and then propose that a better understanding of the extent to which oncologists vary from one another in their use of these therapies at end of life, and by the end of life, we're speaking in the last 30 days, could inform better care of terminal cancer patients. And so the study objective was to determine cross-oncologist variation in the provision of systemic therapies to patients in the last 30 days of life. Now, the methods. So they conducted a retrospective observational study, which is done in the USA, and they used surveillance, epidemiology, and end results, Medicare data. So this is large population level study with large data. And they used multi-level models to estimate oncologist rates of providing cancer therapy, which included some adjustments for some patient characteristics, and we'll hear about some of those. They focused only on breast, lung, colorectal, and prostate cancers. And the inclusion criteria included patients who were 66 years old or older at death, who had been diagnosed during the years 1999 to 2017 and died in the years 2012 to 2017. They included only those patients who received treatment in the last 180 days of life. And systemic therapy, they defined as physician-administered chemotherapy, targeted therapy, and immunotherapy, but not hormonal therapy. They did say they excluded Part D, oral anti-cancer drugs, and that's a USA, I think, particularity around funding, and I think oral drugs are covered by private insurance companies, if I understand correctly. So let's go to the key results. A total of 17,609 patients were included in the study, and of these, 62% had lung cancer. So the majority, 17% had colorectal cancer, 13% had breast cancer, and 8% had prostate cancer. There were 960 oncologists in the study. and 388 practices were included. So the key results, the mean age at death was 74 years old, and the majority of patients, just over half of them, so 53% had stage four cancers, and the time from diagnosis to death was a mean of 15 months. The authors then report the results according to oncologists' percentiles. So oncologists in the 95th percentile are those who treat a higher proportion of patients with chemotherapy in the last 30 days of life compared to other oncologists. And this group, so the top 95th percentile, they found that these oncologists have a treatment rate of 45%. And this means that among these oncologists, 45% of their patients in the last 30 days of life received chemotherapy. On the other hand, the oncologists in the fifth percentile, so the lower end, are those who treat the lowest proportion of patients with chemotherapy during the last 30 days of life. And for these oncologists, only 17% of their patients received chemotherapy in that same time frame. Therefore, considerable variability amongst oncologists. A patient treated by an oncologist with a high end of life prescribing behavior, so the top quartile, compared to an oncologist with a low prescribing behavior, so bottom quartile, had more than four times greater odds of receiving end of life cancer therapy. And then when they looked at patient variables associated with systemic therapy within 30 days of death, they found that these were breast cancer, white patients, patients were married, patients with stage one and two, I guess, understandably, lower age and less months from diagnosis to death. So these were patients who were more likely to receive systemic treatments in the last 30 days of life. Of interest is that the top 25th percentile of oncologists prescribing in the last 30 days also had a higher proportion of hospitalized patients within 30 days of death and also a higher rate of no or late referral to hospice. And so the key discussion points that they highlighted is that there's remarkable variability in practice between oncologists, and it's not explained by disease and patient-related factors. This suggests that factors other than patient preferences or clinical guidelines may be influencing oncologists' decisions to administer chemotherapy to these patients nearing the end of life. They do raise some interesting questions, and I think very pertinent ones. These include questions such as, is there an issue with prognostication training or with knowledge? Or with end-of-life conversation training, or are there personal values at play, and I'm sure there are, or even connections to industry, which is a provocative question, I think, and an important one, though. And finally, they ask what can be done to reverse it. The strengths of the study, it's a large sample, and they say their data is representative of the population, and they explain that in the paper why they say that. In terms of limitations, not all variables were accounted for. For example, they did not look at patient preferences. It's limited to specific ages and diseases. And they also only looked at those receiving treatment within 180 days of dying. So there may have been many patients missed. So I want to share with you Adir's thoughts and the practice impact. And Adir said there are qualitative studies on some of the factors that influence oncologist decisions. And these are good starting points. Adir feels that this study shows need for continuous education of oncologists in the core skills of palliative care, and that includes things such as communication. And he also says, and I quote him, "I also wonder if the rise of palliative care as a specialty has unintentionally removed the responsibility for these core skills from the treating oncologist." So with that, I'll stop and open up for discussion and comments.
Very, very interesting study. I mean, we are seeing studies like this happen in a lot of the clinical specialties, eMERGE and MRIs for back pain, and stratifying preponderance of each physician to quickly order an MRI without red flags, right? So it's a similar thing to me. Lots of comments, but maybe I'll just start with one. It's a provocative thought about whether palliative care has unintentionally caused this. I'm not sure, to be honest. My first reaction is I'm not sure, because I think we would have seen this before as well. It's not like it's gotten worse, I don't think. So yeah, it's interesting. And I wonder whether these higher prescribing people are also the ones who, I would guess and hypothesize, they don't refer to palliative care either, because they're not recognizing the end of life patterns, right? So it's an interesting thought.
Yes, I was also wondering about patterns of referral to specialist palliative care. They mentioned hospice, which is most in the US would be home-based palliative care primarily, if I understand correctly. But we don't know about, you know, whether these cancer centers had on-site specialist palliative care available. And the other thought I had is, you know, whether this is more specific to the American context. I think the rates of aggressive end-of-life care are higher in the U.S. than they are in Canada. So I expect there may be some variability, maybe not as extreme as in the U.S., but nonetheless worthy of further study.
Actually, that's an interesting point, Sharon, because I know that some provinces in Canada, for example, Ontario, one of the indicators for part of an end-of-life care is the use of systemic therapies in the last 30 days. And they've been monitoring that for now more than 12, 13 years. I remember working on this back in 2010 when I was with Cancer Care Ontario. And indeed, the rates in Canada were significantly lower than in the United States for end-of-life, for chemotherapy at the very end-of-life. But that is an important indicator. And I believe that the last report, or it could have been from the Institutes of Health Information in Canada or the Canadian Partnership Against Cancer, where they did look at that as an indicator across some of the provinces. I think that those rates were reported for Ontario and I think as well for BC and Alberta. I don't think that they had data for the other provinces, but again, much lower rates than in the USA.
We have a comment in the chat who mentioned that the study is very concerning and validates observations in the practice. In my practice, I see a lack of comfort with serious illness conversations and ensuring goal concordant care. Would this care not be medically futile and lead to ongoing treatment-related symptoms and distress? And that this approach leads to the falling off the cliff and patient responses of feeling abandoned once the oncologist actually stops treatment eventually. Mm. Yeah, all true, right? Ultimately, these variations are concerning because patient quality of care likely is poorer, be our guess. But then they do make a comment on the limitations as to what the patient goals are, and we can't account for that. And maybe some of that is playing into this, and they are seeking oncologists who are more willing to give. So it'll be interesting things to tease out, isn't it? Yeah.
Okay, with that, Sharon, on to your paper.
Yes.
Fascinating paper.
Yes, it certainly caught my attention. So the title of the paper is Prescription Opioid Use Disorder Among Adults Reporting Prescription Opioid Use with or without Misuse in the United States. It's by Han et al., published in the Journal of Clinical Psychiatry in July of 2024, and came to my attention via perspective article in the New England Journal of Medicine published in November 2024, which I'll briefly touch on after presenting this paper. So the background is that in the U.S., prescription opioids are involved in 20% of opioid deaths, and prescription opioid-related use disorder is traditionally thought to affect a subset of people who misuse their prescription opioids. Accordingly, public health and clinical efforts to mitigate prescription opioid use disorder have focused on preventing and screening for misuse of prescription opioids. There is a national survey conducted in the U.S. called the National Survey on Drug Use and Health, which is used to estimate the prevalence of opioid and other substance use disorders, and including prescription opioid use disorder. So up until 2021, if you reported prescription opioid use, but were not misusing it, you were not asked about the symptoms of prescription opioid use disorder. However, in 2021, the administrators of the survey decided to change their approach. So in 2021, they surveyed 47,000 American adults who were selected to be representative of the general population. And they were administered the survey via computer-assisted self-interviewing. So this was intended to be private and confidential. And they were asked, did you use any prescribed painkillers in the past year that were, so nothing over the counter? And they gave them images of different types of opioids to prompt them. And then they asked, did you use your painkillers in a way other than how they were prescribed? And then they also asked them about symptoms, DSM-5 symptoms of opioid use disorder. This time, everyone who is on prescription opioids answers those questions, whether or not they reported misuse or not. And then, as is recommended, for those people who are using their opioids as prescribed, the symptoms of tolerance and withdrawal were omitted from the symptom inventory. And then they asked some other questions about use of other substances and also whether or not they were on substance use treatment. So the findings were that of the population surveyed, 27% use prescription opioids. So extrapolating that to the U.S. population, 27% of the U.S. population is 68.5 million people using prescription opioids that year. And 12.1%, so 8.3 million, said that they had misused their prescription opioids, and 7% of the population, so 4.8 million, fulfilled criteria for prescription opioid use disorder. So of the people who met the criteria for prescription opioid use disorder, 62%, so the majority, actually were not misusing their opioids. Most of those people had fulfilled criteria for mild opioid use disorder, but some had moderate or severe opioid use disorder. And the remainder, 38%, did report misuse. And in that subset, a greater proportion did have severe opioid use disorder. Now, they did also break it down by illnesses. And so they did include patients who said they had cancer. And so of that population, 7.1% had prescription opioid use disorder based on DSM-5 criteria without reporting any misuse of their prescription opioids. They weren't able to provide numbers on those who were misusing the opioids because of a statistical uncertainty. But nonetheless, there was a significant number of people with cancer on opioids, presumably for pain, who had prescription opioid use disorder. And then when they looked at how many of these people were actually getting treatment for prescription opioid use disorder, the prevalence of treatment was 3.5 times higher in adults who reported misuse than those who didn't. So suggesting that if you report misuse, you're more likely to be offered treatment than if you don't misuse it. And so you're kind of flying under the radar. So the key discussion points were that, so moderate to severe prescription opioid use disorder is more frequent among people who report misusing their prescription opioids compared to those who don't. However, most adults, so over 60% who fulfill criteria for prescription opioid use disorder, don't misuse their opioids and could be overlooked for treatment. And so their message was, we need to screen for and treat prescription opioid use disorder amongst all adults taking prescription or opioids, whether or not they misuse them or not. So the strengths is it's a validated, nationally represented survey with a response rate of 47%. The limitations are, you know, the study design is sectional. They excluded some patients who had a high risk of opioid use disorder, for example, those who are unhoused. And there could be bias in the responses based on recall and social desirability. So turning to the New England Journal of Medicine commentary, so this was called Screened Out, How a Survey Change Sheds Light on Iatrogenic Opioid Use Disorder by Kolodny et al. And so these authors just provided some additional context. So just by changing their questionnaire, the prevalence of opioid use disorder in the U.S. quadrupled from 1.6 million in 2019 to 6.1 million in 2022. And most people with opioid use disorder in the U.S. were prescribed opioids for pain. And most people with prescription opioid use disorder don't misuse their medications. So they did acknowledge that assessing people for opioid use disorder when they're prescribed opioids for pain can be challenging. For example, one of the most commonly reported symptoms was spending excessive time seeking opioids. And maybe that's partly because you're trying to find someone to prescribe them for you. But nonetheless, you know, it's something to bear in mind. And this finding might explain why some people who are using their opioids as prescribed have trouble coming off, because they may have an underlying opioid use disorder. And then also explains why switching to buprenorphine can improve outcomes. So practice impact, be aware that people who are prescribed opioids in the context of life-limiting illness can develop opioid use disorder if they are exposed long enough. So we're not talking about people at the end of life, but people who may be on opioids for over 3 months or even getting into years, and they don't necessarily demonstrate aberrant opioid use behaviors. So screening is needed if we want to intervene and prevent adverse outcomes. However, right now we don't have DSM-5-based screening instruments that are appropriate for the palliative care population. An alternative approach would be to screen for risk of developing opioid use disorder. And for this, there are validated tools that exist. And the other message is to limit exposure to opioids. So if you have a person on cancer, they're on opioids, the disease is getting better, then try to take them off opioids if at all possible. And if it's not possible, then these are populations that may be appropriate for opioids that are less likely to cause harm in the long term, such as buprenorphine. So I'll stop there.
Thank you. A fascinating paper. I was quite shocked when I saw that it came through our editorial committee. And I think you actually brought it to the committee. In terms of tools, let me ask you this, two things actually to screen for risk. I know you mentioned there are a few tools. I know of the opioid risk tool. And I'm wondering, the two of you, do you routinely use a tool like that, like the opioid risk tool or a similar one? Has that become part of your routine practice?
In our cancer center-based care clinic, yes, we do screen routinely because our population, they have longer survivals now than they used to. So we use the revised version of the opioid risk tool. So it's very easy to administer. Unlike the original opioid risk tool, it doesn't have the question about childhood sexual abuse in females. So the questions are a little more neutral. So we do that routinely.
We have talked about it at our centers. In here in Ontario, we haven't. But I do know my Kingston colleagues, they have started doing it as well. And Dr. Matthews, who's on one of our contributors, you know, he has started and they're now doing it routinely in their cancer part of care clinics. Yeah.
And what do you do when it pops up positive or there's a higher risk? What mitigating strategies do you put in place?
Yes. So I guess, you know, we look for opportunities for patients who are nearing, you know, their final months of life, then we're a little more lenient in terms of using opioids. But if we foresee that they have longer survivals, if the disease is stabilizing, then we'll look at opportunities to taper and discontinue. But if they can't, then we switch to buprenorphine.
Can you remind us, Sharon or Angron, what the advantages of buprenorphine in this context? Why buprenorphine?
Yes, well, one is that it's safer because it's a partial opioid receptor, mu opioid receptor agonist. And also, because it's a partial agonist, it has a less likelihood of development of tolerance and hyperalgesia with long-term exposure. And it has some, you know, other effects through the kappa receptor antagonist. It's better for mood. So, and it is less likely to cause a whole host of other opioid, long-term opioid-related adverse effects like endocrinopathies.
Thank you. Fascinating. So let's move to the next one. But before I go to the last one, I forgot to mention the journal that my first article came from. So that was the article on estimating oncologist variability in prescribing systemic cancer therapies to patients in the last 30 days of life. And the first author, Logan George and colleagues, and it was published in the journal Cancer in 2024. So with that, let's now go to the final one. And this is an article entitled Identifying Palliative Care Needs in Patients with Heart Failure Using Patient-Reported Outcomes. And this is a Danish study. And the authors are, I presume it's Lykke, L-Y-K-K-E. I apologize to the author if I mispronounce that, and colleagues. And that was published in the Journal of Pain and Symptom Management towards the end of last year. So the background is that heart failure is a multifaceted syndrome with high symptom burden and also mortality, affects millions worldwide. And I think in the paper, they actually mentioned something like 65 million people worldwide have got heart failure, and that the prevalence is increasing. And it's increasing because of an aging population and also improved survival from ischemic heart disease. They mentioned that palliative care is recommended as part of integrated heart failure treatment in many guidelines, but the implementation is still, unfortunately, relatively sparse. No formal consensus on which patients potentially could benefit from palliative care have been reported. There are a lot of suggestions, but I think the authors highlight that it would be good to have some work done on a consensus-based work on who would benefit from palliative care. And by palliative care, we're talking about the approach and also those patients who may need specialist palliative care as well. So the study objective was to describe the symptom burden in patients with heart failure and identify their palliative care needs using patient-reported outcome measures. So the inclusion criteria were adult heart failure patients in this observational cross-sectional study. The patients had to have systolic heart failure with a left ventricular ejection fraction of less than 40% and symptoms as assessed by the New York Heart Association classification of 2, 3, and 4. In fact, they ended up merging 3 and 4. We will come back to that. They used several validated disease-specific and generic PROMs. So they used the EORTC quality of life tool, the palliative care one, And just to give you a little bit of a background, instrument has got 15 items with two multi-item functional scales. One's looking at physical and emotional function. It also includes multi-item symptom scales looking at fatigue and pain. And then there's five single-item scales looking at dyspnea, appetite, loss, nausea, and vomiting. And the scoring system transforms a score to a scale of 0 to 100. And they equated a score of 33 or more as the presence or a little. And then if it's more than about a score of 66.7, they allocated it as severe or significant. The other tools included the short form SF36, and that's a 36-item questionnaire. The heart quality of life was chosen as their main disease specific, so specific for heart disease, health-related quality of life questionnaire. And that has got 14 items. They've got the multidimensional fatigue inventory, and that's got 20 items. And then the hospital anxiety depression scale has got 14 items. I highlight that because it looks like there are a lot of tools and a lot of items. They got a lot of, I think, very interesting data from it that it's very helpful to know. But perhaps one of our discussions afterwards is perhaps around the burden of using all the instruments. And the study was conducted in a cancer center in Denmark, which included inpatient and outpatients. And as I said, they collapsed the New York Heart Association 3 and 4 groups because of relatively low number of stage 4 or group 4 patients. So the key results, they aimed to recruit 400 patients. They were able to get responses from 314 patients, so a response rate of 79%. 74% of the participants were men. 86% of the patients were seen in the outpatients clinic. The mean age was 74 years, and 42% of the patients had the New York Heart Association 3 or 4 classes. Self-rated health was rated as fair or poor by 53% of all the participants. And when they looked at the symptom scores, the most common ones were fatigue with a mean score of 49 and dyspnea with a mean score of 44. Pain had a mean score of 21.4. Insomnia, quite high as well, with a mean score of 31, and then appetite loss. And the symptom intensity increased with age and higher New York Heart Association class. When they looked at the number of symptoms, in those with class 3 or 4, there was a mean of 8.9 mild symptoms and 5.4 severe symptoms. And 67% of those were experiencing at least 4 severe symptoms. So a high burden of suffering. In the class 2 group, a mean of 5.1 mild symptoms and 1.6 severe symptoms. But interestingly, 19% of those patients had at least 4 severe symptoms. When they looked at the symptom or problem presence, staying in bed or a chair during the day, class 2, 50% of the participants said they're staying in bed or chair during most of the day. And for the class 3 and 4, it was 81%. In terms of help with daily activities, 30% of those with class 3 and 4 reported that they needed help with activities of daily living. Dyspnea was a big issue, high prevalence in patients with class 3 and 4. 92% of them reported dyspnea, I guess, as per the definition of what the class is. And then insomnia was pretty prevalent. 43% of those with class 2 and 64% of those with class 3, 4 had insomnia. Anxiety, which was defined as a HAD score in that subscale of 8 or more, they found in 22% of patients, and depression was reported in 25% of patients. So these are HAD scores for that subscale of 8 or more. And then in terms of the heart quality of life scale, physical functioning scores were lower than emotional functioning. So for physical, 1.36. So the lower it is, the poorer the quality of life, and it's out of 4. So that's pretty low quality of life. Emotional, 2.13. And again, out of 4, that's also getting low. And the global quality of life was 1.58, so getting low. So the key discussion points, patients with heart failure have a high prevalence of symptoms and may have potential palliative care needs, and it's not appropriate to assume that palliative care should be initiated only as a treatment of last resort. So the authors really highlighted this. They made the case that it should be done earlier. And because of its unpredictable trajectory and also this large burden of suffering, that we shouldn't be waiting for a trigger event to initiate palliative care. And for me, that is a big eye opener, because I tend to think and teach around, oh, if you see a trigger event, think about palliative care. Well, they're saying you don't have to wait for that. So strengths, large sample size, the limitations was not necessarily generalizable to the whole Danish population. They did not look at patients with preserved ejection fraction. So the symptom prevalence, intensity, quality of life issues may be different. And they do recognize that they did focus on physical and psychological symptoms, but obviously recognize that there are other domains, dimensions of suffering, so spiritual, social. In terms of practice impact, patients with heart failure have a high prevalence of symptoms and thus potential palliative care needs. Predominantly, women, older patients, and those with higher severity of disease have the highest symptom burden. So we've got to be specifically on the watch out for those. And PROMS can help cardiologists address palliative care needs and should be part of a systematic assessment. And I'll stop there. Any comments or thoughts?
Interesting. I would say a couple of things. There's a lot of tools, which makes it probably impractical in a day-to-day practice, I would wonder about. I would also say there have been studies already that looks at screening and early palliative care, and they're positive even. And so I'm curious about those studies. They were not mentioned at all in this paper. There's a PAL-HF RCT that was actually positive. And there's actually another tool that is actually getting more used commonly nowadays. It's the Kansas City Cardiomyopathy Questionnaire, which is actually a heart failure actually questionnaire with symptoms. And it was used in that RCT, and it predicted supportive care and palliative care needs. And that's only there's a 12-item one in that as well, which is something our virtual CHF clinic in our jurisdiction is starting to use as well.
I'm glad you mentioned that. There was a longer version of the Kansas City questionnaire, right? There was a 23-item, and then the shorter one, 12. There's also the Minnesota Living with Heart Failure questionnaire, which I've seen used in some studies. There's one, I think it was the Netherlands, the NAT-PDHF, the Needs Assessment Tools, Progressive Disease, the Heart Failure one. I'm looking at a list here, the Memorial Symptom Assessment Scale modified for heart failure. And I've also seen the ESAS being used in patients with heart failure with a few modifications. And I don't know, Sharon, if you've got any experience with that. So I think the point you're making is there are quite a few tools that we could use. And I'm sure you'd agree that we should be using these things to identify patients' needs. Sharon, your thoughts?
Yes, I was reflecting on the contrast with the oncology situation where, you know, at least in Canada, use of PROMS and specifically the ESSR really has become, you know, standard of practice across the country. So I think, I totally agree with the need for systematic screening, important to have a tool that's short and simple to use, and also to develop some consensus in the cardiology community about which tool to use.
But I think more evidence on the burden that these patients experience and the importance of palliative care and bring in earlier. So I see we're at the top of the hour. It's time to wrap up. But very quickly, our honorable mentions. So the first one is a study by colleagues of ours in British Columbia, Brian O'Connor and Barbara Pesut. And it's a longitudinal study of within-person trajectories in quality of life in patients receiving early palliative care. And so what they did was they monitored 25 older patients receiving early palliative care, and they completed the McGill Quality of Life questionnaire, and they monitored them over time and concluded that there are reliable changes across time that can be identified in persons receiving early palliative care. So that was one. The next one is a study that looks at ponsegromab for the treatment of cancer cachexia. Now, it is a small open-label phase 1b study. But we thought it was interesting because it signals that there's work happening and we may be seeing things in the future around this area. So basically, they describe the level of growth differentiation factor 15 is a circulating cytokine and it's elevated in cancer cachexia. And in this study, they were looking at this medication, which is a humanized monoclonal antibody that inhibits that particular cytokine, the GDF15. The next one was a systematic review and meta-analysis of randomized controlled head-to-head trials of recommended drugs for neuropathic pain. Do read that. It's interesting. Then there was a study by Pereira, not namesake, that's someone without the eye, and colleagues looking at components of home-based palliative and supportive care for adults with heart failure, and a scoping review, and the finding highlight, for example, that nurses supported by a multidisciplinary team help providing symptom management, patient and care education, discussion of goals of care and advanced care planning, all facilitate home-based palliative and supportive care. Then the last one we want to mention is a study looking at, it's a rapid review of the evidence for online interventions for bereavement support, and the conclusions of that was online interventions can widen access to acceptable, effective bereavement support and improve outcomes for bereaved people. So with that, I want to thank Aingaron and Sharon for being part of this, and for, as usual, Diana and the team in the support desk. Do share with your friends that these exist. Please spread them. Use them in your journal watches or journal clubs if you've got any of those. And again, I'd like to thank all the folks that are monitoring all the journals across the country and internationally. Without your help, this would not be possible. So thank you very much. And until next time, thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. I'm James O'Hearn, and I hope you found it both enjoyable and informative. If you'd like to learn more about the Journal Watch program or our other Palliative Care ECHO Project activities, please feel free to email us at echo@pallium.ca. That's echo@pallium.ca. Or visit our website at www.echopalliative.com. The music for this episode is Dazed by Airtone. Copyright 2012, licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial 3.0 license. You can find Airtone's music at dig.ccmixter.org. Today's episode was produced by Diana Vince. See you soon!